Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. Straight off the bat, I'm going to say thank you to those who purchased the Hemingway book paperbacks. As you know, I've published two books, two classics from the Hemingway list. Two books, but three stories. It's Dubliners by James Joyce. And in one volume, I've done the two Stephen Crane books, The Blue Hotel and The Open Boat. Anyway, you know all about that by now. If you want to get the official Hemingway List books, go to thehemingwaylist.com. There's actually a link in the description for this podcast. A few people messaged me today on Reddit to say that they'd bought them, so thank you very much to those people. And when you get them, be sure to take a photo of them. Share it on the subreddit. Alright, today we're up to Epilogue 1, Chapter 7. In the winter of 1813, Nicholas married Princess Mary and moved to Bald Hills with his wife, his mother, and Sonia. Hey. Well, there we go. That was what I was hoping for. A marriage. Although he has done exactly that thing, hasn't he? Where we don't actually get to go to the wedding. We just get told that it happened. Ah, who cares? They're married. That's awesome. Ooh, I should try to remember that last chapter when Pierre and Natasha got married, and then the rest of the chapter was a horror show. It was just tragedy. So I shouldn't get too excited. Within 4 years, he had paid off all his remaining debts without selling any of his wife's property, and having received a small inheritance on the death of a cousin, he paid his debt to Pierre as well. In another 3 years, by 1820, he had so managed his affairs that he was able to buy a small estate adjoining Bald Hills and was negotiating to buy back Orchard Noe, that being his pet dream. Having started farming from necessity, he soon grew so devoted to it that it became his favourite and almost his sole occupation. Nicholas was a plain farmer. He did not like innovations, especially the English ones, then coming into vogue. He laughed at theoretical treatises of estate management, disliked factories, the raising of expensive products, and the buying of expensive seed corn, and did not make a hobby of any particular part of the work on his estate. He always had before his mind's eyes the estate as a whole, and not any particular part of it. The chief thing in his eyes was not the nitrogen in the soil, or the oxygen in the air, nor manures, or special ploughs, but that most important agent by which nitrogen, oxygen, manure, and plough were made effective: the peasant labourer. When Nicholas first began farming and began to understand its different branches, it was the serf who especially attracted his attention. The peasant seemed to him not merely a tool, but also a judge of farming and an end in himself. At first he watched the serfs, trying to understand their aims and what they considered good and bad, and only pretended to direct them and give orders, while in reality learning from them their methods, their manner of speech, and their judgment of what was good and bad. Only when he had understood the peasants' tastes and aspirations, had learnt to talk their language, to grasp the hidden meaning of their words, and felt akin to them, did he begin boldly to manage his serfs, that is, to perform towards them the duties demanded of him. And Nicholas's management produced very brilliant results. Guided by some gift of insight on taking up the management of the estates, he at once unerringly appointed a bailiff, village elder, and delegate, the very men the serfs would themselves have chosen had they had the right to choose, and these posts never changed hands. Before analysing the properties of manure, before entering into the debit and credit, and he ironically called it as he ironically called it, he found out how much cattle the peasants had, and increased the number by all possible means. He kept the peasant families together in the largest groups possible, not allowing the family groups to divide into separate households. He was hard alike on the lazy, the depraved, and the weak, and tried to get them expelled from the commune. He was as careful of the sowing and reaping of the peasants' hay and corn as of his own, and few landowners had their crops sown and harvested so early and so well, or got so good a return as Nicholas. He disliked having anything to do with the domestic serfs, the drones, as he called them, and every one said he spoilt them by his laxity. When a decision had to be taken regarding a domestic serf, especially if one had to be punished, he always felt undecided and consulted everybody in the house, but when it was possible to have a domestic serf conscripted instead of a land worker, he did so, without the least hesitation. He never felt any hesitation in dealing with the peasants. He knew that his every decision would be approved by all of them, with very few exceptions. He did not allow himself to either to be hard or punish a man, or to make things easy for or reward anyone, merely because he felt inclined to do so. He could not have said by what standard he judged what he should or should not do, but the standard was quite firm and definite in his own mind. Often, speaking with vexation of some failure or irregularity, he would say, "What can one do with our Russian peasants?" and imagined that he could not bear them. Yet he loved our Russian peasants and their way of life, and with his whole soul, and for that very reason had understood and assimilated the one way and manner of farming which produced good results. Countess Mary was jealous of this passion of her husband's, and regretted that she could not share it, but she could not understand the joys and vexations he derived from that world, to her so remote and alien. She could not understand why he was so particularly animated and happy when, after getting up at daybreak and spending the whole morning in the field or on the threshing floor, he returned from the sowing or mowing or reaping to have tea with her. She did not understand why he spoke with such admiration and delight of the farming of the thrifty and well-to-do peasant Matthew Ermishin, who with his family had carted corn all night, or of the fact that Nicholas's sheaves were already stacked before anyone else had his harvest in. She did not understand why he stepped out from the window to the veranda and smiled under his moustache and winked so joyfully when warm, steady rain began to fall on the dry and thirsty shoots of the young oats, or why, when the wind carried away a threatening cloud during the hay harvest, he would return from the barn flushed, sunburned, and perspiring, with a smell of wormwood and gentian in his hair, and gleefully rubbing his hands would say, "Well, one more day and my grain and the peasants will all be under cover." Still less did she understand why he, kind-hearted and always ready to anticipate her wishes, should become almost desperate when she brought him a petition from some peasant men or women who had appealed to her to be excused some work. Why he, that kind Nicholas, should obstinately refuse her, angrily asking her not to interfere in what was not her business. She felt he had a world apart, which he loved passionately, and which had laws she had not fathomed. Sometimes, when trying to understand him, she spoke of the good work he was doing for his serfs. He would be vexed and reply, "Not in the least. It never entered my head, and I wouldn't do that for their good. That's all poetry and old wives' talk. All that doing good to one's neighbour. What I want is that our children should not have to go begging. I must put our affairs in order while I am alive, that's all. And to do that, order and strictness are essential. That's all about it," said he, clenching his vigorous fist. "And fairness, of course," he added, "for if the peasant is naked and hungry and has only one miserable horse, he can do no good, either for himself or for me. And all Nicholas did was fruitful, probably just because he refused to allow himself to think that he was doing good to others for virtue's sake. His means increased rapidly. Serfs from neighbouring estates came to beg him to buy them, and long after his death the memory of his administration was devoutly preserved among the serfs. He was a master, the peasant's affairs first, and then his own. Of course, he was not to be trifled with either. In a word, he was a real master. All right, there we go, another chapter down. Just quickly going to do a little bit of advertising. Firstly, I am going to advertise the books in the Hemingway list. Jump over to thehemingwaylist.com and look for the link that says our official paperbacks. If you're on a desktop, it'll be on the right-hand side. Otherwise, you have to scroll right down to the bottom and you'll find it. Our official paperbacks. Or you can search for them on Amazon. Just search the Hemingway list. This podcast is also brought to you by Podbean. Podbean is actually the service that I use to host this podcast, and they are offering a month free hosting for anyone who would like to start their own podcast. If you go to podbean.com/ander, you can get a month free. That's a pretty good deal. And if you do start your own podcast, let me know. I'd love for more sort of spin-off podcasts within this community. Maybe we can guest on each other's shows or something like that. Could be kind of cool. So, podbean.com/ander. Alright, thank you very much for your patience. So, Nicholas turned out to be a strict, harsh but fair and firm master on a farm with serfs. I'm not really sure how serfs differ from slaves. I'm going to look up serfs versus slaves. A lord of the manor could not sell his serfs as a Roman might sell his slaves. On the other hand, if he chose to dispose of a parcel of land, the serfs associated with that land stayed with it to serve their new lord. Simply speaking, they were implicitly sold in mass and as part of a lot. Can serfs be sold and bought? What a weird thing. Serfdom just seems so very much like slavery, doesn't it? But I don't understand the finer details and how it's different. Anyway, he seemed to be a fair slave owner. So, make of that what you will. And he did a good job of farming and cleared his father's debt, cleared his debt with Pierre, but showed very little kindness towards his serfs, didn't he? Princess Maya could not quite understand why he would refuse to give them days off, or would refuse to sort of show any leniency at all with them. But then the serfs themselves seemed to respect him because of that. They respected him as a fine master. Now, Ernie Pook made a good point. Ernie Pook asked, Mademoiselle Boreen was not mentioned as living with Nicholas. Do you think she has been cast aside like a sucked orange? That's a good euphemism, I suppose. Cast aside like a sucked orange. I think, do you reckon she's there? She's probably there, she's just in the background. There was a lot of chapters that took place in the Bolkonski estate where she wasn't mentioned. So, I don't know, maybe she's just in the background in this chapter. Royal Enigan said, I think Tolstoy just ignores that characters still exist at his convenience. De Fleury said, they say cockroaches will survive the nuclear war. Ernie Pook also asked, is it just coincidence that Tolstoy gave Nicholas Rostov and the old prince Nicholas Bolkonski the same name? Rory Lenigan said, Andrei's son is named after his father, as Andrei was named for his father's father. Right. De Fleury said, it is just a coincidence that Princess Mary surrounds herself with men named Nicholas. Yeah, I think it is just a coincidence. Lastly, Ernie Pook said, it seems like Nicholas has found peace and fulfillment in his new bucolic life. Is this his happily ever after, or is there a threatening cloud on the horizon? Bucolic. Good word. Bucolic.
Bucolic.
Relating to the pleasant aspects of the countryside and country life. It's a bit like idyllic. Rory Lenigan said, I wonder if some part of Nikolai's life here is modelled after Tolstoy's own. There is some social acceptance that a wife and husband live in different worlds where they will never understand each other. In our modern worldview, we can see inequality and struggle there, but that is given the perspective we have now. A lot of couples say it's really healthy to have separate lives. Your own thing. You do your own thing. You come together at the end of the day, but yeah. That's a debate for another day, though, isn't it, really? Rory Lenigan also said, I think this chapter furthers Tolstoy's holistic theme throughout the book, that a subtle understanding of the inevitable whims of life in society is necessary to be successful. De Fleury said, Rostov enjoys bossing around the peasants a lot more than Prince Andrew, Pierre, or old Bolkonski ever did. He's always been the opposite of intellectual. Well, I don't know if he took pleasure in especially bossing them around. I think he took pleasure in sort of running a tight ship, getting out of debt, doing what his father sort of failed to do, like just having a good work ethic, getting things done, and sort of trying to be proper about it. That was what I sort of saw there. He was trying to sort of prove himself as a working man. Well, everyone's married. I'm pretty happy. We just need to see what happens to Sonia, and then we're all set. But that's pretty good. We'll wrap up the episode there. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.